Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an examination of whether the choice of Jack Lew as Secretary of Treasury means that financial reform will not be a priority in Obama's second term. Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, joins us to discuss whether budget reform will supersede financial reform in the next 4 years. Then we will speak with Edward Kleinbart, who was Chief of Staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, to explore an alternative scenario the President might follow to avoid the threatened shutdown of the U.S. government by congressional Republicans over the debt ceiling. We will discuss Ed Kleinbart's plan to issue federal scrip if the Treasury is unable to issue new debt, which is outlined in his article in the New York Times, The Debt Ceiling's Escape Hatch. Then finally, with the Church of Scientology marketing its brand of so-called religion in a television ad campaign, we will speak with John Sweeney, a veteran BBC war correspondent and award-winning investigative journalist, about his latest book, The Church of Fear, Inside the Weird World of Scientology, that chronicles his contentious experiences with the Church of Scientology, filming the 2007 BBC Panorama special, Scientology and Me, and his 2010 follow-up, The Secrets of Scientology. And joining us now is Michael Greenberg, who's a former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Currently, he's the director of the Center of Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures, options, and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Greenberger.
Good to talk to you, Ian.
And you're quoted as saying that Jack Lew is the best we can hope for, very smart, very fair-minded, but he isn't an expert in markets. Given his remarks in a few years back in a Senate hearing that he didn't think that financial deregulation led to the financial crisis, where he said, I don't believe that deregulation was the proximate cause. I would defer to others who are more expert about the industry to try and parse it better than that. That's a pretty troubling analysis of the worst economic crisis to hit America since the Great Depression.
Yes, it was very disturbing. He delivered those remarks and testimony before the Senate, and it was very disturbing at the time. And the White House, by the end of the day, tried to soften it by saying that wasn't markets were not his expertise. First of all, there are two issues here. One is whether this evidences the fact that there's not going to be a lot of attention paid to market reform, and I think it clearly does evidence that fact. But the more important issue is the Secretary of the Treasury, by virtue of Dodd-Frank, is the person who's principally in charge in his capacity as chairman of the Financial Stability Oversight Council, of preventing any kind of financial calamity by examining big institutions that may be unstable and taking them apart before they cause problems. And then secondly, if a financial crisis arises, the Secretary of the Treasury is in charge of responding to it to make sure we don't go falling into another Great Depression. And that's my foremost concern here. I mean, one thing is, as we sit, Wall Street, every time there's not a crisis to focus the American attention, Wall Street runs away with the regulatory system. In the last few weeks, there have been some moves made by regulators that have been very favorable to Wall Street, very harmful to the American investor and American taxpayer. Jack Lew will not come in to try and correct that problem. He's very smart, he's very able, has an excellent reputation, and by the way, he's socially progressive, but he's not familiar with markets. And I think the president is very focused on the debt ceiling crisis, but I'll tell you, we could default on our sovereign debt, which would be terrible, but if we have another financial crisis akin to what happened in 2008, there simply isn't $12 trillion available to remedy it as we did then. And to have somebody who isn't fully expert in markets leading the rescue is, to me, quite troubling.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Future Trading Commission. Currently, he's the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures options and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. But one of the things that I find troubling about the resume of Jacob Jack Lew is this revolving door between government and Wall Street and back to government. It's also the same path that Rahm Emanuel took and others. And it feels as if there's something sort of rigged about it. You go from government service, you do a couple of years on Wall Street, and you make a ton of money, even though you probably don't know what you're doing. But the feeling I get is that these big banks give these people a very short tenure and a big golden parachute. And then they go back into government. And by the way, it's what's really troubling is that Jack Lew was on Wall Street at Citibank or Citicorp at the very time that all of this toxic derivatives and fraudulent mortgage packages were being put together. How do you feel about that?
It is troubling, and what's even more troubling to add to the list of troubles is that there were an array of former Clinton officials who went to Citibank, Citicorp, under the tutelage of Bob Rubin, who that's where he was chairman of the executive committee, what have you. And as you know, Rubin, when he was Clinton Secretary of the Treasury, was very hostile to regulation. I have been comforted by my discussions with people who know Lew and believe that he will not be tainted by that experience. And that's why the quote you read, where I think it's the best we could hope for, is I think he will be a fair-minded, unbiased decision maker. That's his reputation. He's on social issues, very progressive. But he's clearly not familiar with markets, and we need someone who is going to stand up to Wall Street, and I fear that he's just not going to have that in him, not because he was at Citigroup, but because he doesn't understand these issues. What I'm comforted by is that I think he will listen to common sense and those in the administration who are market reformers, who caused the passage of Dodd-Frank, but he really is going to have to answer the question, does he have the wherewithal to be in charge of the 10 major bank regulators in both detecting systemic risk or answering a challenge that the kind we faced in 2008, which was systemic risk. The point here is that most objective economists, market observers, believe that there is a high probability that the episode of 2008 will repeat itself. And if that were to happen, we don't have $12 trillion to throw at the issue this time around. And the question is, will Jack Lew be prepared to either detect the problem or respond to the problem? And I think that's what he's got to answer in his confirmation hearings.
But I guess, though, the bottom line is that as Secretary of Treasury, he's also the nation's top financial regulator. And you don't feel that that's going to be his priority because he's so deeply immersed in these budget battles.
What I think is it's certainly not going to be a priority of his. I feel confident of that. But the question I have is, what is he going to do if week number two in office there is a repeat of a Lehman Brothers situation where another financial institution has a rogue trader loses $6 billion in one fell swoop, and the bank is threatened with defaults, and we're right back where we are again. He's going to be the chief guy responsible for dealing with that. And he's not going to have, as we had in 2008, the willingness of the American people to bail out these banks to the tune of $12 trillion. So whatever his priorities are, he may have this priority forced on him. And the question is, does he have the ability to respond? I clearly, because the defense of this statement that he made, that deregulation was not the proximate cause of the 2008 meltdown, the defense of that statement was he doesn't know markets. Well, he's got to be able to say, which no one is focused on right now, but I'm sure will be by the nomination, confirmation process, rather, what are you prepared, what are you skilled at in terms of facing what many people think there's a high probability of facing, is a financial event that, if unmet, could lead to the second Great Depression.
So, again, Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Future Trading Commission, it's hard to get your head around the idea that after all that we've gone through since 2008, and we still have the legacy of 2008, which is the deficit that all the deficit hawks are so worried about, that's led to the Tea Party tantrum over the debt ceiling that brought about the sequester, that brought about the fiscal cliff, and now we're going to have another round of a possible government shutdown over the debt ceiling. That's the crunch is coming in a matter of a month or so. So we all know what's happened recently, but you're telling us that at any moment, one of these big banks could make a terribly bad bet and be poised to go under, and then turn to the Treasury and say, write us a blank check, and the cupboard is bare. The very fact that you can say that with such certainty makes me so alarmed. I'm thinking, what have we learned? What has happened? Has anything been put in place to stop this? We've already had one near-death experience. In other words, the patient is still in danger?
The problem we have is that memories are short, and it's just not memories from 2008, but in 2012, we had the experience of J.P. Morgan losing $6.2 billion based on one trader's negligence. Now, J.P. Morgan had enough capital at stake that didn't present systemic risk. But if a weaker institution had one trader who did that, and we've had experiences of that sort, that could bring down an institution who would then default on its obligations and lead to the cascading crisis. So it's not just what happened in 2008. We've had a near-death experience in 2012 with J.P. Morgan. But after that was May of 2012. For the next two or three months, everybody got worried about regulation and reform. But then it disappears, and the public's attention and the public officials' attention, distracted by financial campaign contributions, goes away. And right now we're in a period when no one's worried about a big bank failing. And I think it's imperative, and I have some degree of confidence that it will come up in his confirmation, that people will say, are you prepared to deal with this? Again, it's not just responding to a crisis, but Dodd-Frank gives the Secretary of the Treasury the responsibility for detecting a crisis before it happens and dealing with it. And I think the question is this candidate, nominee, able to do that? I frankly think the thing that might comfort me is him saying, well, okay, I don't have the expertise, but I will have at my side the following people who do have expertise. What also troubles me is some of those people, for example, Gary Gensler, who's the present chair of the CFTC, and many of us believe is the most effective Obama administration official in dealing with financial crises. If he were to say, well, I'll rely on Gary Gensler and people like that, that would be reassuring. But right now, people are worried about defaulting on the sovereign debt, which no two ways about it, if it happened, it would be a calamity. But it would not be the calamity that another Lehman Brothers presents, because a Great Depression, without ammunition to deal with it, is going to boost unemployment, lower the stock market, and create a worldwide event. And I think the American taxpayer, American investor, needs to be reassured that this candidate will be able to deal with that issue.
But as the top cop on the beat that's supposed to be, you know, to be the first to know whether the markets are overextended and somebody is making reckless bets. And I'm not sure that there's a mechanism of transparency to know that. But we certainly know that the other top cop at Justice, the head of the Justice Department, hasn't really gone after anybody. So there's been no punishment for 2008. And if Lew is not aware of what's happening and he's going to have to rely on somebody else, and you mentioned Gary Gensler, who in fact comes from Goldman Sachs.
And has been a very effective market reformer. He's been, as far as I'm concerned, the best friend of the American taxpayer that has been presented by the Obama administration.
And what about Elizabeth Warren? Is there any early warning system? That's what I'm asking you.
There is the ability for an early warning system, but as you say, it's not easy. I think there is enough transparency out there that if you have somebody who understands and can detect the signals properly, would have the ammunition to head off a crisis before it starts. The question is, with all of his strengths, and he has tremendous strengths, will Jack Lew be able to do that? When I said he's the best we can expect, I mean, there were discussions about the CEO of BlackRock being the Secretary of the Treasury, or other people who are on Wall Street, who I think would not have the American taxpayers' interest at stake. I think we're lucky because Lew is, I believe, not going to be biased. The question is he going to be helpful in the sense of being able to detect or respond to a market crisis? I don't say we're going to have a market crisis. What I say, and many others say, is the probabilities are very high. We may be lucky, but we should be prepared and have people who are prepared to deal with such a thing happening. And so many people, responsible academics, market observers, senators, are very worried about a repeat of the Lehman Brothers situation in 2008.
Well, just in closing, Michael Greenberger, the president, there's a lead article in Thursday's Los Angeles Times front page story, Obama hasn't reined in big money. Relaxed inauguration rules reflect how he has largely given up the fight for what was once a high priority. And there's a sense that Obama has dropped his efforts to curb the role of money in politics. And he's obviously made an issue out of it. So are we looking at some overall bad signals here?
The bad signals are, you know, it is the height of irony that Wall Street completely abandoned the president and favored Romney in the last election. The president did not get elected because Wall Street supported him. He got elected because the average Joe taxpayer decided that he would protect the economy better than Romney is. He owes nothing to Wall Street, and yet we turn around and it seems as if, despite the fact that they didn't support him, that that's too high on his agenda. And, you know, the only thing that can stop that is the American public being informed, telling the White House and telling their senators and members of Congress, hey, you know, we can't let Wall Street go unreined. And I'm telling you, we don't have time to talk about it, but in the last month, there have been several actions that have been taken by the Fed and other regulators that are giving Wall Street a break and ignoring the interests of protecting the American taxpayer from having to bail these big banks out again.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Greenberger.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Greenberger, who's the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Currently, he's the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures options and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Ed Kleinbart, who has an op-ed in Thursday's New York Times, The Debt Ceiling's Escape Hatch.
How my money's spent to cook my stays and joy. cannot beat. Yeah. Don't give up. I know you can make it good. Though I
saw it all. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edward Kleinbart, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. Before joining USC Law, he served as chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and he has an article in Thursday's New York Times, The Debt Ceiling's Escape Hatch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Kleinbart.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And I imagine somebody at the White House has noticed your op-ed in Thursday's New York Times. You're throwing them a lifeline, aren't you?
Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. You know, I've sat patiently by my phone, but the president didn't call today. I hope somebody there read it. You know, what I'm trying to do is exactly that, is to throw him a lifeline that enables the president to defang the threat of the sort of extortionate demands that have been suggested will be made to avoid the debt ceiling, and to do so in a way that won't pile a constitutional crisis on top of a fiscal crisis.
Well, we've had some pretty wild suggestions, like the trillion-dollar platinum coin, and also the 14th Amendment route. So let's just shoot those two down quickly, if you will.
Well, sure. So the 14th Amendment route it relies on the fact that Section 4 of the 14th Amendment says that no one will do anything to question the validity of the federal debt. And the argument is that Congress itself has questioned the validity of the federal debt by creating the debt ceiling, and so the president can simply ignore the federal legislation in the form of the debt ceiling law because the 14th Amendment commands him to. And you know, that's just not right. And Lawrence Tribe at Harvard, you know, wrote a very good op-ed in the New York Times a year ago. You know, the point is a straightforward one. The Constitution is very clear that investing in Congress alone the authority to control the borrowing capacity of the United States, and the idea that the president can simply ignore that and borrow as much as he pleases really just flies in the face of the Constitution. And the funny thing is, the platinum coin has a lot of the same problems. You know, the platinum coin idea is that we have, again, a very elaborate statutory framework based on the Constitution. Congress alone can regulate the money supply of the United States, can coin the money. Congress has done so. We have elaborate statutes that actually tell the Treasury how many dollar bills they can print and the like. And somewhere, you know, way in the middle of this, there's one little paragraph that says, and Treasury can issue platinum coins. And it's very clear from the history and the context that that was intended to enable Treasury to do simple commemorative coins, not to issue coins, platinum coins that you and I would spend at the 7-Eleven. And so what people have done is said that because Congress didn't think to say, and you can't issue $1 trillion of these, that therefore Congress has in effect surrendered all control over the money supply, which again the Constitution vests solely in the Congress, to the Treasury, and the Treasury can effectively create as much money as it wants by creating little platinum coins and depositing them at the Federal Reserve. You know, it's fantastical on its face, and it's a grave constitutional affront to the Congress, and it's not a good idea to pile a constitutional crisis on top of what would be a fiscal crisis. We have enough problems in this country.
And I guess the bottom line here, Ed Kleinbart, is that it would invite suits to before the Supreme Court, and even the Congress would probably call for impeachment, wouldn't they?
Well, you know, I don't want to give them any ideas. I don't want to give them any ideas, but I think the House of Representatives would view it as, you know, a direct affront to the Constitution, and the kind of argument that if you were to make in a first year law class at law school, you know, you would be derided by the professor for completely misconstruing the statute and having no understanding of how statutory interpretation is going to work. And the people who are promoting it are sophisticated legal scholars, but I believe they're doing so because they're desperate. They're desperate for a way to give the president some negotiating leverage. But I don't think it's a good idea to do that in a way that exposes him to this kind of perfectly, you know, non-trivial constitutional controversy.
Again, I'm speaking with Edward Kleinbart. He's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. Before joining USC Law, he served as chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation and has an article in Thursday's New York Times, The Debt Ceiling's Escape Hatch. Let's then turn to your solution that you're offering the president in the event that the Republican Congress decides to go to the mat and have another debt ceiling crisis as they did last time. And the last one, by the way, did cause the U.S. To be downgraded by Standard & Poor's, Moody's, I believe. And of course, that would add that those deficit hawks that brought that about ended up adding to the deficit because they raised the cost of our debt. This time around, they can do some serious damage. And so clearly anything to avoid this, and the president has basically laid down a marker saying he's not going to negotiate over this. Last time he sort of got suckered into the negotiations. This time he's laying down a real red line there. So given that we're heading to another showdown here inexorably, Ed Kleinbart, tell us about your solution of federal scrip.
My solution, just to understand, is a terrible idea. It just happens to have the advantage of being the least awful idea going around to enable the president to, as I say, defang the most extortionate demands of one party in Congress. And the idea is a very simple one, and it's one that's going to be familiar to a lot of readers, a lot of listeners in California, because it was inspired in part by the California experience in 2009. And, you know, the great thing about living here in California now is it's a little sort of like a little natural experiment in how to deal with dysfunctional legislatures. So, you know, we have a lot of expertise here. And the idea, very simply, is that that the government has lots and lots of bills. Some of them are in the form of Treasury debt obligations, Treasury bills in the technical sense, short-term debt obligations, bills, notes, and bonds. Those are classic debt obligations. Those continue to get paid in cash. Those are when people think about Treasury securities. That's what's relevant. But the government has lots and lots of other obligations other than those classic debt instruments. It has to pay the electric bill. It has to pay its vendors. It has to pay its employees. It's made promises to Social Security beneficiaries, and on and on and on. And so the idea is for those federal obligations that are not debt instruments, to pay the electric bill, to pay vendors, to pay defense contractors, even if they decide to pay Social Security beneficiaries, part of the payment would take the form of scrip, what in California was called a registered warrant, and what we all know as IOUs. And what the IOU would say is, yes, we owe you the money, and no, we can't pay you right now. Sorry. And when we can pay you, then we'll pay you. So the instrument itself is just evidencing a financial obligation, which itself is not a debt instrument, and the IOU does not create a debt instrument, so we don't have a debt ceiling problem. And then, unlike the platinum coin idea, we don't have to go to the Fed and it sort of enlist their help as a co-conspirator. Then we rely on the private markets, which is what happened in California. And if you get this script and you need cash today, you sell it. You sell it to the bank. You know, you sell it to a securities dealer. And because everyone knows that the crisis will be resolved in a few weeks, the banks are going to pay very close to par. They're not going to pay par because in my construction, the instruments don't bear interest. But they'll pay very close to par because they're going to get a terrific return compared to any other kind of treasury instrument that they could possibly buy. Instead of getting 1% a year, they'll get 1% in a month. So you'll be able to monetize your investment, but not by the treasury issuing $1 trillion of money or $1 trillion of new securities, but rather by the private markets doing that. And in that way, I've substantially reduced the constitutional controversy, and I get almost all the cash into the pockets of people who need cash immediately. And for those reasons, I think it's the superior solution.
And it's a solution that, as you point out, has already been tried, tested, and it worked in California in 2009 when California had its budgets crisis and it issued 450,000 registered warrants, scrip, in other words, yes, totaling yes. $2.6 billion. How does that compare? I mean, the only scrip that I recall, not that I was around at the time, but in World War II, soldiers were paid in scrip. Is that the same thing?
Well, you know, I don't know the World War II experience.
But the government's issued scrip before, in other words.
Well, the federal government has not issued scrip like this in 100 years or more, to my knowledge.
Right.
I'm not suggesting it's something that the federal government has done before, because the federal government has never run out of money before. The difference right. between this and other experiences is...
Well, it's not running out of money in a month or so, at any rate. It's just the politicians some politicians have decided to make an issue, an ideological issue, out of something that's been a long-standing mechanism, the debt ceiling.
That's absolutely right. And it's critically important that people understand that the debt ceiling, to understand two points. The first... The president does not control spending. The Congress alone determines the spending of the U.S. government, just as Congress alone determines the money supply and the borrowing of the U.S. government. So this is a problem of congressional Republicans versus congressional Democrats, to a large extent, in which the Republican Party, unfortunately, has decided to try and strong-arm its way of thinking instead of doing it through the regular order of debate, which we would have in a couple of months anyway, when the fiscal year 2014 budget comes up for debate in March.
Well, there you have it. I mean, Ed Kleinbaum, I mean, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Edward Kleinbaum, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. Before joining USC Law, he served as chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and he has an article in Thursday's New York Times, "The Debt Ceiling's Escape Hatch." We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Church of Fear, Scientology.
You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in the middle of negotiations, you break down. I never give you my number.
Might be. I'm get the picture? Are you telling me I should come out of the closet now, Mr. Ron?
No, my son.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Sweeney, who is in London. He's an investigative journalist with the BBC's flagship television program Panorama. Previously, he worked as a newspaper journalist with 12 years at The Observer, where he covered wars and revolutions in more than 60 countries, including Romania, Algeria, Iraq, Chechnya, Burundi, Sierra Leone, and Bosnia. In 2002, he defied Robert Mugabe's ban on the BBC, reporting from inside Zimbabwe to reveal mass graves in the country, and his reports have included the death of the former Russian security officer Alexander Litvinenko in London 4 years ago. John Sweeney has won the Paul Foote Award, the Royal Television Society Award, and an Amnesty International Award for human rights work in Chechnya, Kosovo, and Algeria, and an Emmy for coverage of a massacre in Kosovo. He's the author of several books, including The Life and Evil Times of Nicolae Ceausescu and Trading with the Enemy, Britain's Arming of Iraq. His latest book just out is The Church of Fear, Inside the Weird World of Scientology. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Sweeney.
Hello.
So, to some extent, you've obviously been fascinated by Scientology. I'm speaking to you from Los Angeles, which is ground zero for Scientology. And there's been, of course, some coverage in the Los Angeles Times several decades ago that was very unfavorable, and it indicated that the Church of Scientology is extremely proactive in going after journalists who cover them or trying to shape the stories, or if they fail to do that, then do as much as they can to discredit the messenger. Tell us about your run-in, because when you had a run-in with them live on television, it went viral on YouTube. So take us back to that moment and what motivated you to do this book.
Well, first of all, you ought to know, your listeners ought to know, that the Church of Scientology says that I am psychotic, a bigot and a liar. They've said that I am the reporter from the depths of journalism hell, and the Church of Scientology blog has said John Sweeney is genuinely evil. So as far as the Church is concerned, your listeners are listening to somebody who is bad and mad and dangerous to know. However, I've met a bunch of ex-Scientologists, and I've met and spent time with them, who say the Church of Scientology is bad and mad and dangerous to be in. So there's a huge chasm there. But the story starts in 2007, 5 years ago, and I'm investigating the church for a BBC Panorama. It wasn't live, actually, but anyway, I'm investigating them, they're investigating me, and a series of completely weird and creepy things happens to me, I say, and people can look up the program. It's called Scientology and Me, and there are around 7 million hits in various forms on YouTube. So what happens is we talk to ex-members, and two senior Scientologists turn up at a hotel at midnight. The next day, I'm at a Scientology event a little way away from where we were, and the same guy, Tommy Davis, who creepily looks and talks like Tom Cruise, turns up and berates me, and we have a great big argument. Then again, I meet another critic of Scientology who I'm interviewing, a man on top of a car park, and Tommy Davis pops up again and starts reading out his criminal record from 10 years ago for having sex, consenting sex with men in a public place. Get to LA, and we are followed. There is a car chase. It's very, very, very creepy. There's a creepy guy in our hotel. Nevertheless, the church invites me to meet their celebrities, and I meet Kirstie Alley and Leah Rimini from King and Queen and Juliet Lewis and Tommy Davis's mum. This is the guy who looks like Tom Cruise, who's been following me around. He's my host, as it were. And this guy introduces me to his mother, who's Ann Archer, whose bunny got boiled in Fatal Attraction. So then they take me to their Industry of Death Museum. Scientologists, including Tom Cruise, believe that psychiatry is some form of Nazi pseudoscience. And it's beyond weird, Ian. It's deeply, deeply disturbing, because what I'm being presented with is an image of psychiatry, which after all is only medicine's attempt to deal with the mentally ill, as some kind of inherently evil and kind of Nazi thing. And it's like telling the history of heart surgery through only dead people who didn't survive heart operations, and greedy and vile heart surgeons without any mention of all the good they've done down the years. So it's beyond strange. And then there is a moment when I've just had too much. They've told me that the Holocaust was caused and planned, created by psychiatrists. And I know this in my head to be wrong, but I can't. I don't have the facts at my fingertips, but they go on to say, Tommy Davis goes on to berate me something else about this chap, the late Sean Lonsdale, a critic who he'd read out his sexual misdemeanors from a decade before. And he said, you know, you were soft on him. And I wasn't. I'd asked Sean a tough question about that, I was certain, and I lost my temper. I apologize then. I apologize now. My book, The Church of Fear, is my attempt to tell the whole story, to tell readers what it felt like to be kind of inside. I mean, I wasn't in it for any length of time, but I had a very, very close embrace with the church over those weeks, and what it feels like to feel as though you're losing your sanity, you're losing your grip on reality. I felt I was being brainwashed. I feared I was going to lose my mind, and what happened was I lost my voice.
Again, I'm speaking with John Sweeney, who's an investigative journalist with the BBC's flagship television program, Panorama. He is, prior to that, he was a journalist for a couple of decades, covering wars and revolutions in more than 60 countries. He's author of a number of books, The Life and Evil Times of Nicolae Ceaușescu and Trading with the Enemy, Britain's Arming of Iraq. His latest book just out is The Church of Fear, Inside the Weird World of Scientology. So, Scientology, of course, there's some question about how many members it has, whether it's exaggerated its membership, and there's been some reports in the press recently that they are losing members. Of course, the most prominent members are a couple of Hollywood celebrities, John Travolta and Tom Cruise. But there's been some high-level defections, and I know in your book you've got electronic communications that have been somehow intercepted between the head of the Scientology and others. There's David Miscavige, who's supposedly the number two guy, apparently, in the church, is Tom Cruise, at least according to recent reports. But there was a very senior fellow that defected, Marty Rathbun, who was the Inspector General of the Religious Technology Center here in Los Angeles, which is one of their organizations. Give us an idea of why there are so many senior defections. I believe Miscavige's wife has been missing for 5 months as well. So what's going on there in terms of defections within the inner circle?
It's there has been a real hemorrhage of top Scientologists in the past. In the past 5 years, the key one for me, it was a guy called Mike Rinder, because as well as being followed around by Tommy Davis, I was also followed around by Mike Rinder in 2007 after our program. He defected, and he had been the head of their version of the CIA, which is called the Office of Special Affairs. And Mike told me after he left that if you were a senior Scientologist, you suffered abuse. Now, these are all allegations that the church deny. Remember, the church says that I'm psychotic, a bigot, and a liar. Mike Rinder says that he was abused physically and mentally for years and years and years, and this was standard routine. He says he was beaten 50 times. The church deny that. Miscavige denies that. Other senior Scientologists still in deny that. They say Mike and Marty, Mike Rinder and Marty Rathbun were violent, as were others. But anyway, this is what Mike Rinder says. And he also says that Miscavige sent him a series of very abusive emails. Now, in the BBC, I send abusive emails to my bosses all the time, and they send me back. I mean, they're often tongue-in-cheek, and they go up and down. All of these emails I have are, they're only one way. The abuse is from the top, from Miscavige's communicator. Remember Miscavige, David Miscavige, he's a short man, Tom Cruise's best man, very, very intense guy and the successor to L. Ron Hubbard. To give you a flavor of this, Mike Brinder says that one of the coded sign-offs that Miscavige liked to use was to his minions, YSCOHB, and that stands for You Suck Cock on Hollywood Boulevard. Other messages were equally vulgar, counterintuitive, cocksucker, you suck, you suck, you suck, you suck, you suck. About me, are there any new tears in this guy's asshole? I mean, very, very strange. And I find it hard to believe that, for example, the Archbishop of Canterbury would ever use a phrase like, you suck on Hollywood Boulevard.
Well, for some reason or other, the Church of Scientology was able to become a church and get its 501c3 tax exempt status here with the IRS in the United States, which means that they are treated like a church and are a charity and are tax exempt. The means by which they got their tax exemption was reported by the Los Angeles Times, where Miscavige actually showed up at the top man's office, and prior to that, they'd harassed IRS auditors and proactively gone to their homes and interviewed their neighbors of people that work for the IRS. So, again, they had this very proactive way of getting business done. But it sounds like within the organization, which is very celebrity-driven, that Miscavige lives like a princeling, modeling the lavish life of his closest friend and companion, Tom Cruise. But meanwhile, down in the galleys, like in a Roman slave ship, you got people working for nothing, imprisoned, if you will.
Now, there's a lot of evidence that says that. To play devil's advocate for a second, the church says that's all untrue and that Miscavige is a great man. And they have lots and lots of people who say that's not true. The difficulty in, for example, a British libel law is that you have to prove the truth of an allegation. And that's tough. In America, the test is the plaintiff has got to prove actual malice. But here's the thing for your listeners, Ian. The church says, according to ex-Scientologists, people have left, that they believe in a space alien Satan, an intergalactic warlord called Lord Zanu, who 75 million years ago brought space aliens to the planet Earth and blew them up with H-bombs inside volcanoes. And the remains of these dead space aliens infect humanity and cause all of humanity's ills. Now, the church deny that. They say that's not true. And I've asked Kirsty Alley and Leah Rimini and Julia Lewis, and they laughed at me and said, John, you're crazy. Tommy Davis interrupted, said, John, you know, this is just crazy. You're weird. You're creepy. But the ex-Scientologists say, no, it is true. So here's a simple test. If the Church of Scientology isn't involved in, interested in fighting space aliens, concerned about space aliens, then I want all of your listeners to have a look and note down the name of a mountain. It's called Mesa Huafenita, and it's in New Mexico. I'll spell it M-E-S-A, new word, Huafenita, H-U-E-R-F-A-N-I-T-A. And you look it up on Google Earth or any other big satellite map and track east of Mesa Huafenita, and you will see a landing strip. North of that is Ziggy Zaggy Road. North of that, two enormous space alien signs you can only see from the sky or space. Ex-Scientologists say this is a 5,000-acre property owned by the Church of Scientology. Underneath the ground are vaults. In them, a H-bomb-proof vaults protected with argon, and in that are gold discs, or discs on gold, of L. Ron Hubbard's lectures. He was the founder of the church, and the great Hollywood film which has just come out, The Master, is about L. Ron Hubbard. On the top of the mountain, you can't see it from the road, you can't see it from the earth, these weird space alien signs. And your listeners can go and have a look and see for themselves. The church deny their space alien signs. They say they're there to help the pilots land the planes. And I say, well, listen, I've been to hundreds of airports in my time, and I've never seen great big space alien signs helping you land in LAX or Heathrow or JFK. It just isn't like that.
So, obviously, we don't have much time to go into the breadth of what you've reported in your new book, John Sweeney, about Scientology, The Church of Fear Inside the Weird World of Scientology. But one of the things, of course, that keeps coming up all the time is, and there was a recent defection of a very, very prominent screenwriter and film director here in Los Angeles who was an ardent Scientologist who broke because the Scientologists had financed Proposition 8, which was a ballot measure here in California to ban gay marriage. And his own daughter was gay, and he felt there was a lot of hypocrisy within the church about sexuality. And of course, there's been endless reports in the press about Tom Cruise and John Travolta's sexuality. And you mentioned earlier that one of the people that had talked to you, an ex-Scientologist, they tried to slime him by revealing his sexual proclivities. What is this weird business about? If it's true that they're covering up prominent people's sexuality at the same time attacking other people for their same sexual proclivities?
I think my difficulty with this is that I don't think the government or reporters should mess about in other people's bedrooms. The problem is the church does proclaim other people's sexual indignities and use them, so that this critic, Sean Lonsdale, that they brought up his sad sexual past. It wasn't terrible. It was with consenting men. Frankly, who gives a damn? But there are issues about Cruise and Travolta's sex life which speak to the integrity of the church's confession. Now, what ex-Scientologists have told me is this, is that the members of the church may not realize it. The church says they do, but some perhaps don't, is that when they confess, it's called auditing, they do so, they're holding the cans, which are linked to a dial. There's an auditor, the confessor, is confessant, in fact. The role of the priest is taken by a guy called the auditor, and he's working a 1950s-style lie detector or truth detector, and it can detect anxiety. When you sweat more, your hands conduct more electricity. The water in the sweat does that, and you can see the agitation on the dial. And they ask probing questions. Who did you have sex with? What did you do? What was she wearing? What was he wearing? This kind of stuff. Now, what ex-Scientologists say, and critically, is a guy called Mark Headley, he's the main source on this, though there are many others. He's the guy who I went to New Mexico with to see the space alien base in Mesa Huerfanita. But Mark used to fit, he says, pinhole cameras into these auditing suites so that people from outside the room could see what was happening. They could see the dial and listen and hear and watch Tom Cruise talk about the most intimate details of his sex life. And I know ex-Scientologists who have done that, who have told me all about listening to Tom Cruise's most intimate secrets. And the same goes, people say that they also heard intimate secrets about John Travolta. Now, it's not my job, and I'm not going to go into the detail of that. I don't want to know. But the point is this, is the accusation against the church is that they have spied on their own Hollywood apostles, Tom Cruise, John Travolta, the others. And there is a historic court case from 1984 in which this has been brought up by a judge, in which he refers to a kind of blackmail, because if these people leave, if the adherents back in 1984, the judge was talking about, if they left, then they would face a kind of blackmail because they know the church has got all of the dirt on them. And by dirt, I mean intimate sexual secrets. Now, that's a question which it's very, very difficult to put to people like Tom Cruise and John Travolta because they're protected by a wall of publicity agents. And when, for example, they certainly go on British television, nobody, it seems, none of the people who get to interview them ask about Scientology, and certainly not the darker aspects of Scientology. So there is a wall between these celebrities who, in their some sense, sort of say, you know, you can feel it happen, that they're telling their fans, you know, hey, look, I'm successful. I'm a Hollywood star. Look at me. Maybe the implicit message is maybe, you know, you do Scientology and it'll do you good. There is no scrutiny of that suggestion, and that feels to me to be wrong. But what's happening is that because of our amazing technological revolution, because of the internet, ex-Scientologists talking to each other with an ease and a speed they've never been able to do so before, thanks to the internet. By the way, the Church of Scientology hates the internet. It's got a nanny net, and some of the senior Scientologists I spoke to, Kirsty Alley, Ann Archer, whatever, we don't do the internet, we don't like it, da-da-da. So that's happening, and it almost feels as if there is a Scientology spring that's happening, that's beginning to break down the walls, because it's got a ferocious reputation, but it feels as though, at the moment, it's in trouble.
Well, John Sweeney, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with John Sweeney, who's an investigative journalist with the BBC's flagship television program, Panorama. Previously, he worked as a newspaper journalist with 12 years at The Observer, where he covered wars and revolutions in more than 60 countries, including Romania, Algeria, Iraq, Chechnya, Burundi, Sierra Leone, and Bosnia. In 2002, he defied Robert Mugabe's ban on the BBC reporting from inside Zimbabwe to reveal mass graves in the country, and his reports have included the death of the former Russian security officer Alexander Litvinenko in London 4 years ago. John Sweeney has won the Paul Foote Award, the Royal Television Society Award, and an Amnesty International Award for human rights work in Chechnya, Kosovo, and Algeria, and an Emmy for coverage of a massacre in Kosovo. He's the author of several books, including The Life and Evil Times of Nicolae Ceausescu and Trading with the Enemy, Britain's Arming of Iraq. His latest book just out is The Church of Fear, Inside the Weird World of Scientology. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.